Well, love it or hate it, good stuff or good riddance, one thing everyone can agree on is that 2016 did not lack for big stories on the national front, internationally, and here in Vermont. With the torch about to be passed to a new year, we're taking a look back at some of the biggest stories from 2016. And joining us for this recap is VPR political reporter Peter Hirschfeld. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Mitch.
You know, it's fair to say that 2016 was dominated by political news, sort of inevitable in a presidential election year. Let's start then with Bernie Sanders and his historic run for the Democratic presidential nomination. He announced the bid in 2015, but it wasn't until this year that his candidacy really took off and sparked a movement. That movement got a big boost when Sanders won the New Hampshire presidential primary in February.
We have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California.
Ultimately, of course, Sanders did not win the Democratic primary. But, Pete, you covered the race and even went to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. What stands out most to you about Sanders' bid for president?
Well, that clip that you just played is definitely one of the moments that stands out. It takes me back to that cold night in early February, sitting in the Concord High School gymnasium where Sanders was going to give that speech, and watching the election returns come in on my phone. If you recall, Bernie Sanders did not simply win New Hampshire. He took the state by 23 points. And it was this moment when all of a sudden a pundit class in the national media that had in some ways written this guy off as a socialist curiosity realized Bernie Sanders is for real. Other moments that stand out for me came on VPR News's trip to Iowa about a week before the caucuses there in January. We all knew Bernie Sanders was a popular guy in Vermont, but it was eye-opening to see how deep his appeal was to folks living 1,200 miles away from us. One last moment I'll share that stands out for me were the four nights that VPR spent at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. And for a lot of Sanders supporters, it was a pretty bitter end to his candidacy. But to listen to Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech was to appreciate how big an impression that Bernie Sanders had made. There was Hillary Clinton talking unabashedly about raising taxes on wealthy individuals and large corporations to pay for things like free public college tuition for working class Americans. No matter your politics, there is no denying that Bernie Sanders' candidacy galvanized a huge segment of the electorate and in many ways reshaped a lot of the political boundaries in this country. And it's going to be fascinating to watch the national landscape over the next 4 years to see how his legacy plays out.
It was still a pretty big year for Vermont in terms of elections as well. Governor Peter Shumlin announced last year he would not seek another term, and so the race was wide open. In the end, Republican Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott won the gubernatorial race, beating former Transportation Secretary and Democratic nominee Sue Minter by a wider margin than a lot of people were expecting. The day after the election, Scott said that his runaway victory amounted to a mandate from Vermont voters.
They want some action on the economy. They want to be they don't want to have to struggle. They don't want to have to work two and three jobs to make ends meet.
Pete Hirschfeld, how would you characterize the 2016 gubernatorial election? And what do you see as some of the biggest challenges Scott will face as he takes over as the state's highest executive in January?
I think this was an election that featured two candidates with some starkly different views about the role of state government in Vermonters' lives. Sue Minter wanted to raise the minimum wage. She wanted to institute a mandatory paid family leave policy. She wanted to tax banks and use the money to pay for free community and technical college for any Vermonter that wanted it, regardless of income. Phil Scott, meanwhile, argued that it was time to stop elected officials from using government as a way to intervene in private economic activity. He wants to lower the growth rate in state spending. He wants to make targeted tax cuts that he thinks are going to benefit certain industries. And now we get to watch the incoming Republican governor try to implement his agenda with a legislature that's controlled overwhelmingly by Democrats. Now, the partisan dynamic might seem to lend itself to gridlock and strife, but there are some key Democratic lawmakers, like incoming House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, like incoming Senate President Tim Ash, who sound like they actually share Phil Scott's concerns about the sustainability of state spending levels. And it's possible, especially in the face of so much uncertainty at the federal level, that we might see a more copacetic budget process than a lot of folks are anticipating. What's going to be interesting to watch is how legislators handle some of the big policy issues, like a minimum wage increase, like paid family leave, like marijuana legalization. Will they move forward aggressively and invite a showdown with a governor who has expressed in no uncertain terms his opposition to those kinds of programs, or are they going to dial back on those initiatives? I think we'll get a sense pretty early on how this session is going to play out.
Of course, Vermont does not exist in isolation, and like everywhere else, Vermonters reacted to the biggest story of the year, the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States. What has been the reaction in Vermont?
Well, that's an awfully difficult question to answer. There are people here who were thrilled to see Donald Trump elected president, and they think he's the kind of change maker this country needs right now. There are far more people living in Vermont who were disappointed at best in his win and were in some cases, I think it's fair to say, pretty traumatized by it. What's interesting now is to see how anti-Trump Vermonters are beginning to organize in the wake of his election. You're starting to see a lot of activist groups across the state talk about intersectionality, is the term they use. They talk about fusion movements. They think that Donald Trump's win has the potential to be a watershed event for some of the progressive movements that they've been trying to jumpstart. And we'll see over the next couple of years what sort of traction they can get in the wake of what they see as a common enemy.
Well, somewhat related to that was another big Vermont story that was also generated by headlines well outside of the state, and that's the huge debate in Rutland after Mayor Christopher Luris announced plans to have the city become a resettlement site for up to 100 Syrian refugees.
This community is at a time in its history when we must seize the opportunity to welcome the next generation of new Americans escaping a desperate situation of war and chaos.
Now, that's a story that's still ongoing, especially given President-elect Trump's statements about refugees entering the United States. But what has been the impact and the reaction among people in Rutland to this point?
Well, there are folks like Mayor Christopher Luris, who we just heard there, who said this proposal is going to be the shot in the arm that Rutland's economy needs to move forward, bring in some fresh faces, bring in some new members of the workforce, and let's get this town going. There are also folks who saw this relocation proposal as their opportunity to play really a direct role in trying to alleviate some of the suffering and hardship that these residents of Syria have endured. There are other people in Rutland who think that this is a grievous overreach by federal, state, and local governments. They say local input should have mattered in this decision, that this shouldn't be left to someone like the mayor to decide whether it's right or not. They say bringing 100 Syrians to Little Rutland will put a serious strain on government services like public education. And if you follow social media platforms related to this topic, it becomes abundantly clear that there are some people who simply don't want to share a community with non-white Muslim immigrants. Now, Donald Trump has pledged to ban the immigration of Muslims from countries like Syria, so that could throw a wrench in this resettlement plan. If all goes according to plan, though, we're going to find out soon enough how seamlessly this transition is going to go, because families could begin arriving as soon as next month.
Well, another story that broke big in 2016 was, to say the least, pretty complicated.
This is not a depiction of a simple bank robbery. Rather, this depicts what we allege to be a massive and complex fraudulent enterprise.
That was the voice of outgoing Attorney General Bill Sorrell during a press conference that outlined charges against the owner of the Jay Peak Resort. The Securities and Exchange Commission alleged Jay Peak owner Ariel Quiros and CEO Bill Stenger used the federal EB-5 program to dupe foreign investors out of some $200 million. Pete, bring us up to speed on what happened at Jay Peak and what's happened since those allegations came to light.
You know, I can still remember first reading through that SEC complaint that was filed in federal court back in April. And the scope of the allegations was so broad, so severe, and it was suddenly clear that this series of massive development projects in the Northeast Kingdom projects that had been touted vigorously by some of the most prominent politicians in the state was in fact nothing more than a Ponzi-like scheme to defraud foreign investors of, as you said, $200 million. The suit listed two defendants. There was JPEEK owner Ariel Kuros and his CEO Bill Stenger. The SEC has since dropped charges against Stenger in exchange for his cooperation in the case. It should be noted that the state continues to have charges pending against Bill Stenger. But the federal case is proceeding against Ariel Kuros, and a federal judge issued a ruling last month that says he was, in fact, the mastermind behind one of the biggest frauds in state history. One of the big questions still hanging over this episode is, how did this massive fraud elude detection by the state regulators who were supposed to be overseeing the state's EB-5 program? Now, regulatory oversight has changed drastically since all of this happened, but there are still a lot of unanswered questions about how government agencies could have remained blind to a crime of such epic proportions that was going on under their noses.
Now, a story that started off in southern Vermont and has grown to encompass the whole state is the discovery of the suspected carcinogen PFOA in drinking water. Initially, drinking wells in North Bennington were found to be contaminated, and subsequent state testing has shown PFOA cropping up around the state. What has Governor-elect Phil Scott said about how he will handle this ongoing issue, and who is responsible for cleanup and potential compensation for this contamination?
Well, you know, the whole episode has been a sobering reminder for everyone of how vulnerable our drinking supplies are to chemical contamination. And it's been an especially trying time for the folks who found out they'd been unknowingly consuming contaminated water, in some cases for years, especially when you hear state officials say that they frankly don't know what kind of physical harm people are going to suffer from drinking this contaminated water. Phil Scott says he's going to take an aggressive approach. He's appointed a Secretary of Natural Resources who says this is going to be one of her big priorities. It's unclear precisely what sort of steps they're going to take, but lawmakers have begun taking some small steps to improve detection protocols, for instance, to try to give residents and towns more tools to hold industries responsible for leaks that do affect water supplies. You know, I was talking with VPR reporter Howard Weiss-Tisman, who's been covering this story for VPR from the beginning, and he said, you know, the episode begs a lot of questions about what else is out there in the way of contamination. The only reason that state officials have detected PFOA in all these locations is because they've launched a targeted effort to find it. There are a lot of other chemicals that have been used for industrial purposes over the years that we largely are not testing for, and it looks like this episode is going to put a bright new spotlight on issues of water safety in Vermont.
Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing lots more from you as the legislature gets back into session next week. VPR's Peter Hirschfeld covers politics from our Montpelier Bureau. And thank you so much for speaking with us, Pete, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Mitch.